We're talking about naturalism. We started that conversation last week. We started looking at definitions of naturalism, and we left off on page 5. But tonight we're going to start on page 6. We're going to just skip the rest of page 5 because it gets a little nitty-gritty, and I just want to get into some really good stuff. And if you want the words for the places that I left open for you to fill out, I'm planning on emailing this out afterwards, and you'll have those words, and you can write them in, okay? Rachel, is that red light? Is there a red light on the middle of that screen right there?
Yes.
Okay, on the top? Okay. Yep, okay, cool. All right, I'm not going to get in trouble. All right, so please turn to page 6, not in the new outline that you just got, but in the outline from last week, okay? All right, anybody not there? It should say at the top, naturalists propose a blank. Yeah? All right. That's on page 6 of the old outline from last week. Yeah, that's...
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
You're reading,
not reading the top. Yeah, the first line down. Thank you. Okay, so naturalists propose a grand story. We're picking up right where we left off in the same train of thought of what is naturalism, what is scientism. We're defining it right now in a philosophical sense because it's a worldview, and we're understanding what that is so that we can understand how to address it. Now again, naturalism and scientism, I'm not talking about science, I'm talking about a worldview or a philosophical system that people on the street hold or those in academia hold. So naturalists propose a grand story, and this is their main grand story. These are the main features of their grand story. They propose an atomic theory of matter. Yeah, thank you. And then they propose evolutionary theory. They propose that all of the happenings and history of the earth can be explained by natural matter and not even emergent entities exist. Okay, so most naturalists would say that emergent entities, something like the mind, they would say, that could be called an emergent entity, that doesn't even exist. Some naturalists would hold that an emergent mind does exist, but most naturalists don't. And so they're saying that all of the happenings in the history of Earth can be explained by natural matter, so that you don't need any persons involved to explain the history of the Earth. You don't need any free agents, such as a person or a god, to explain any event in the history of the Earth. It's just matter acting upon matter. It's just an entity moving another entity. It's a cause creating an effect, creating a cause, creating an effect. That is how they can explain the entire history and the happenings of the entire earth. Yes? Yeah, is there anyone here that did not get a new outline? Ashley's going to be our TA for the evening. And we're not in that outline yet. We will be shortly. Raise your hand if you did not get a new outline. Okay, and the next item, particles change and merge by mechanical and material causes, forming other stuff with no teleological purpose, meaning that particles just move around and they merge together by mechanical and material causes. Just mechanical and material causes. Again, no free agents. Just things hitting against each other. Everything. Everything. My actions right now, your thoughts, you're holding the pen, all of that is just matter acting on matter. And there's no teleological purpose. There's no end goal in sight. It's just, it does what it does, and there's no reason or purpose behind it. And next, there are no free agents. Again, there's no one like myself or yourselves who act on something in a free, choice, out of your own free volition or your own free will. There are no free agents. Physics and chemistry determine causal happenings. Physics and chemistry determine causal happenings. So everything that happens is just based on the results of a physical or a chemical phenomena. Laws of physics cause things to happen. Laws of chemistry cause things to happen. Determinism is at the physics level, and it fixes the chances of the state of the universe. In other words, when things are determined, there are no real opportunities for variation. There's just determinism. Things just happen. Things are determined. One thing leads to another, and it could not have been otherwise. That statement I just made, that could not have been otherwise. That statement was caused by neurons firing in my head, and those were caused by other things related to my childhood, related to my parents' childhood, all the way back to medieval times, to Moses, whoever, and to atoms and amoebas. All of these things are causing me to do this right now. Determinism at the chemical level for all other phenomena. So everything. You think of something, that is from a deterministic cause and event, cause and effect, even at the chemical level. All right, so now there are other definitions of naturalism. Philosophical naturalism, also known as materialism, is defined as this: the spatio-temporal universe of entities that is studied by the hard sciences, such as biology, chemistry, physics, is all that is and could ever have been or will be real in the universe. Okay? So this is known as philosophical naturalism, also known as materialism. So what that is basically saying is the only real and existing entities are those which exist in the space-time causal universe. So no non-physical entities could exist. Nothing exists, nothing outside of time can exist, and that which is not caused could not exist. So the only thing that exists is matter. The only real thing in this entire universe is matter, is material, is something that's in the space-time universe. Nothing that is non-physical, nothing that's immaterial, nothing that's an abstract entity could possibly exist. Number two there, note that this is a philosophical position which holds that reality is only the material universe. So the only thing that is real is that which is matter. Nothing else is real. Matter or physical stuff is the only thing in existence. Nothing else exists except that which is physical. So most naturalists hold to this view. And there's a quote I'm going to read you. Digging around here, Jack in the Box, what else? Okay. All right. So now, again, this is different than the common definition of naturalism, which we just passed through. This is known as materialism or philosophical naturalism. It's a little different. Okay? And so this is Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is a famous atheist. The universe is nothing but a collection of atoms in motion. Human beings are simply machines for propagating DNA. And the propagation of DNA is a self-sustaining process. It is every living object's sole reason for living. Okay? So that's you and me. We're just a machine. We're propagating DNA. That's our purpose. Okay, so this is Richard Dawkins. Now, Francis Crick, one of the main discoverers of DNA, you and your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. So your entire behavioral system, everything about you, all your memories, all your fears, all your pains, joys, and sorrows, that's just a bunch of molecules and nerves and cells and the like. So again, most naturalists would hold to philosophical naturalism or materialism. Now, methodological naturalism is the view that says that science should explain phenomena only in terms of entities and properties that fall within the category of the natural. Answers to all questions are to be sought out only within nature. The physical universe is the proper object of scientific study, and methodological naturalism is the proper method for pursuing that study. So this is, again, a philosophical worldview people in academia hold or people on the street hold. Epistemological naturalism, again, that's epistemological. I'll write it down. Nothing can be known of entities other than nature. So the word is epistemological. That just says that how do we know things? Epistemology is the philosophical branch or field within philosophy known as epistemology. It just says how do we know things? What is knowledge? How do we acquire knowledge? So all this view says is that nothing can be known, there's no knowledge outside of nature. Okay? Anthropological naturalism is just saying that humans are wholly a part of nature. So I kind of described this. So some of these views kind of overlap. And some philosophers or writers will use them interchangeably. And they'll just kind of, they won't make these finer distinctions. They'll kind of be a little sloppier with their wording, which is fine. Most people know what they mean. But if you really get into it, there's a more sophisticated, nuanced breakdown of the views. Now, scientism is a little different than naturalism. There's a statement right here, a quote from a famous atheist philosopher, Bertrand Russell. "What science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know." Okay? So scientism is the view that what constitutes knowledge is only that which science can describe, test, or yield. What is rational and true is that which science can verify. Okay, this is the view of scientism. Okay, so knowledge is only that which science can tell us is real or true by its testing or its yielding of results. Weak scientism is a little softer position there. Weak, W-E-A-K. Weak, as in Jeremy's weak. Weak sauce. Weak scientism is the view that fields of knowledge outside the hard sciences are not completely worthless, but offer no intellectual results concerning reality. Other fields are vastly inferior to science, as they are matters of mere opinion and belief. Okay, so this basically says that sociology, philosophy, psychology, all the humanities, those are all inferior, but they're not completely worthless. They're almost completely worthless, but not quite. So if you're in that field and someone who holds this view talks to you and you talk back to them, they're going to think what you're saying, if it relates to your field, is almost completely worthless. It's all a matter of belief or opinion. So for instance, if a sociologist was to testify before Congress and say, or testify about how video games they're seeing a trend in society amongst kids that are 12 to 18, those who play violent video games are more violent, and we can see a growing trend in more violent video games coming out, there's more violence on the street, something like that, right? And a sociologist, and there's a team of them, they testify before Congress and they write this big report. The person who holds to the weak scientific view would say that what that person says is just mere opinion. It's just a matter of preference. And you can get another sociologist who will contradict them, and both are saying opinions. There's no real knowledge or no real statements of value. They're almost worthless, what they're saying. Now, strong scientism is slightly different. It says that science is the only source of knowing anything at all. So it's not like the sociologist is just speaking opinion. He's not speaking anything. It's completely worthless. That's this view, strong scientism. There's no value in the speculations of fields of knowledge outside of science. That is, thoughts that are worth having are only scientific thoughts. Those are the only ones that are worthwhile, that we should even talk about, that we should even teach and reason with. And non-scientific thinking is worthless because science alone gives knowledge. That's the whole idea. Science alone gives knowledge. This is strong scientism. Okay, now with scientism, there is what we call an epistemological exclusion of first principles of philosophy. That is, any a priori knowledge of or innate ideas are rejected as unknowable. What do I mean? Well, this is the idea that an a priori, by the way, is a Latin, I didn't put it in italics, sorry, but it's a Latin phrase. It just means from the earlier. And that whole concept is that if I'm sitting down in an armchair just thinking, playing Monday morning quarterback, you know, commenting on the activities the day before and Peyton Manning's interception in overtime, these are just kind of ideas that come just by pure reason and rationality. There's no testing or experiential data that I'm encountering or dealing with. It's just all innate ideas. It's stuff that I think up on my own. Okay? And then contrast that with the Latin phrase a posterior, or a posteriori, meaning from the later, meaning after experience or after observation. And so empiricism, this point five here, is this idea known in philosophy called empiricism. And empiricism is the idea that there are no innate ideas. There are no innate ideas. So this whole number five is this idea of empiricism. And again, that means that it says you cannot have any knowledge from being just a rationalist philosopher sitting in the armchair. You have to go out and experience the world to acquire knowledge. So empiricism is the idea that all knowledge is gained from the five senses or experiential data. So I'm experiencing the light in this room. It's, you know, causing this to look kind of brownly to me. I'm experiencing gravity. I feel my feet on the floor. I see people out there. There's different colors. I'm experiencing the world, and I know that there's people out there because I'm getting sensory data. So the five senses, taste, touch, smell, sight, sound. Did I get them all? That is how I acquire knowledge. I can't acquire knowledge in any other way. That's the idea of empiricism. And so what scientism is saying is that you cannot acquire knowledge through innate ideas. Ideas that are just given to us when we're born, for instance. Like, it's not okay to go and throw a ninja star at my brother. You know, that is not good. That idea of killing my brother with a ninja star is not good, and I know it's not good because it's an innate idea. I-N-N-A-T-E, innate. Something that I can acquire in my knowledge a priori. When I was a baby, I could have known this if my reasoning faculties were efficient enough. I can know that I'm alive as a baby. I don't even have to open my eyes. The first thought I think I could know as a baby, I'm alive. That's a priori knowledge. And so scientism says there's no a priori knowledge. Everything that you think or has been taught to you has been acquired through empiricism, through a posteriori knowledge, through experiencing the world, either from somebody else experiencing the world and telling you, or you experiencing the world. Okay, now that's important. I wanted to kind of hash that out because we're going to kind of talk about that a little later. And number six, all other fields of study that are non-science just do not provide knowledge. So we talked about that a little bit. So this is the idea of scientism. So now we've talked about naturalism. Now we've talked about scientism. Okay, so in conclusion, well now again, we're just giving definitions. That's all we're doing. And these aren't mine. I'm getting them from all those books in the back and other places. And again, I want you to kind of cruise through those books and kind of get familiar with those authors and see if you like any of those books and order them on Amazon. Don't take mine. That would be great. But the idea is to get you familiar with these things. So in conclusion, all we're saying here is based on the above definitions, these worldviews seem limited. They seem limited. They seem to be missing something. And again, that's the first sub-premise of our premise there at the top of the page. Scientism and naturalism are easily defeated and ought to be rejected. So I'm just saying that that just by definitions alone, when we look at the definitions, when we understand what these views are, they just appear to us initially as limited. So one must question these systems of philosophy. We must ask whether or not these systems of philosophy are appropriate to hold. Is science the supreme giver of knowledge? Is it the ultimate authority? Is the natural physical world all that there is? Before we ask these questions, we need to understand where these worldviews came from. So the first question I ask in understanding where these worldviews came from, I ask, does the scientific method have anything to do with the worldviews of naturalism? Okay, so we're going to start talking about the scientific method just briefly. But before we do that, does anyone have any questions? All right. The scientific method, number two. This is, again, a sub-premise. If you have your in the flap of your book there, the structure of the argument, you can see now that we're moving to the sub-premise under the sub-premise one, this is sub-premise two, but we're again under the premise number one, scientism and naturalism are easily defeated. Do you see that in your flow of thought on your structure? I'm asking you to put that kind of on the flap so you can refer to it for such times as this. When you see a big bold underline, that means we're transitioning between premises or sub-premises. the structure is on page 32 of a previous outline. Does anyone, Brittany, hi, can you pass that back? Okay, so now we're moving into this idea, the next sub-premise here, that the scientific method does not necessitate naturalism as a worldview. So what do I mean by that? Well, if I'm looking at the scientific method, I don't get naturalism as a worldview from the scientific method. So I'm saying that the alleged sacred ritual of the scientific method is something like this. Formulate hypothesis and get a tentative explanation or some working explanation. Make predictions about future events. Verify test, analysis, interpretation, evaluation of test results, publish, and reproduce. Do it again. Okay, so this is one formulation of the scientific method. There are others, but it's something like this. And the next one below there, you could see the little diagram. That's just straight out of a biology textbook. And the stuff above I got from another scientist. But this is an example of a scientific method. Observation or idea leads to hypothesis, leads to experiment, leads to conclusion. And between hypothesis and experiment, you may need to do some revision. Again, this is just another version of it. There are others, but this is the general idea. You kind of get this idea or observation, you do some tests, and you get a conclusion, and you kind of do it again and make sure it's all working. You keep doing that. There's nothing sacred about this. Again, so next page. Notice that this is a method to generate a conclusion or a theory. There's nothing sacred or spiritual about this method. Special. It is a simple, straightforward approach to understanding phenomena of the universe. So it's very simple. That's all I'm trying to say. I'm not saying there's something wrong with it. I'm not saying there's not something wrong. I'm just saying it's pretty simplistic. But it's held in very high regard. Notice that naturalism is not the conclusion of such a method. Okay? Nowhere in that flow of thought do you get the worldview of naturalism. You don't get that philosophical system spitting out of the scientific method. No matter what test you do on what phenomena, naturalism and scientism are not the result. Naturalism is not implied or presupposed by this method. So at the end of the day, it's definitely not a direct conclusion, and it's not even implied. It's not an implied conclusion. And it's not presupposed. In other words, I don't have to be a naturalist to do the scientific method. I can be a Buddhist and do the scientific method. I could kill people for the fun of it and do the scientific method. Okay? So naturalism is not presupposed by it. So it doesn't really matter where I come from. I can still do that method. Now, what I'm about to get into, which I'm not going to, is this view of presuppositions and how they affect the results of our studies. And so that's a very long conversation and kind of detailed. And I wanted to skip over it. And the reason why I'm kind of skipping through a few things is because I'm just looking at where we're going in the next, I guess, 7 weeks if we're trying to stick to this 10-week mark. And I'm realizing that we're not going to get there in time. So based on my estimations, it's going to be 15 weeks. And some of you may freak out and explode when you hear that. So I'm trying to gauge this flow and gauge you and see what we want to do when the middle of March comes around. Do we want to keep going or do we want to aim towards that? So kind of think about that, and maybe in the next couple weeks we'll talk about whether or not to try to compact it into 10, because that's all you can do because of traffic, whatever, or if you want to kind of slow a little down and go to 15. So think about that. At this point it seems like we'll have to do at least 12. So it looks like going to end of March just to get through the material I prepared, and that's going hyperspeed, Mach 1 through it. So it's like we just need to think about that. Okay, so what we're going to do is skip into the next outline that I passed out, or Ashley passed out. Okay, now, so you're going to be on page 1, and we're actually going to skip page 1, 2, and 3. We're going to land on 3 right in the middle. Now, the reason why I'm skipping that, and I want you to read that, there are no blanks in that part, is if you can read this stuff that we're skipping on your own time, the reason why is because that just kind of traces this idea of empiricism as it was developed in the Enlightenment time and how it affected Christianity and evangelical Christianity, and how different things that happened during the Enlightenment based on science and philosophy of science, rationalism, empiricism, and other methods had an effect on the Christian community, especially in the Western world, and especially in colonial America. And we can see that a lot was lost in terms of the Christian intellectual heritage due to different philosophical systems coming down from the ivy towers of academia into the streets. And so the colonial Americans, based on my research, had lost a sense of their great philosophical background that the Catholic Church really had put together for them. Now, we like to blame the Catholic Church for lots and lots of evils. I like to blame them especially for lots of evils, but we really throw out the baby with the bathwater when we say all of the Catholic Church is all evil. Because Protestantism didn't even come around until 1600. And so a lot of the great theologians of our Christian heritage were Catholic. You know, that's kind of, there was only one church. Well, there is the Orthodox church, but they were a lot smaller. And they didn't have as much influence on the West. So when I say we, I mean Western Christians. And we lose a lot. We lose a lot of Aquinas, Augustine, all these early church fathers who really wrestled down some of these philosophical ideas during their time and produced volumes of amazing, beautiful thought. And some of these guys are regarded by secular atheist philosophers as some of the greatest minds who ever lived. And they were Christians arguing for Christian concepts, but doing so in such a brilliant manner, way before their time. Most of the theologians I know today can't touch Augustine, Aquinas, Calvin, Luther, all these guys, and those are just kind of the big names. We look to those guys. We stand on the shoulders of giants. For the Christians that are in this room, you should be very have a sense of pride in the type of intellectual rigor that your faith rests upon, that was developed and articulated so well by these guys. And we can go into that a lot. But a lot of that was lost. There is the church, the Christians left their brains in the library and then stopped going to the library. I mean, that's kind of how it happened and how the next couple hundred years unfolded. I mean, they just forgot to think. And in doing so, philosophers that were not Christian just kept producing volumes of material, and the Christian heritage turned into something of a fairy tale. And so, this kind of part of this is reclaiming some of those amazing intellectual thoughts that were lost during that time. Now, atheists such as Peter Atkins, a chemist at Oxford, who's written tons of chemistry books, he thinks that any arguments the Christian presents are just repeat arguments from 1,000 years ago. And if we were to say these 1,000 years ago, people would have been like, yeah, good stuff. But nowadays, he says, people are more reasonable than that, and any Christian arguments that are presented are just a waste of time. And he's a person who holds to scientism, Dr. Peter Atkins. Okay, so, rabbit trail. But there's a little bit of background. That's kind of what those pages are that we just skipped over. All right. So page 3. What we'll do, actually, because it's right about 7:45, so it's a perfect time to take a break. So why don't we take a break for about 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I think there's a lot of snacks back there now. So I would encourage you to go do that and get to know each other next to you and make friends. All right, thanks. Okay, so this is session 2 here, week 3. And we're on page 3 of the new outline. And what we're about to do is we're about to look at 10 problems, legitimate problems, with naturalism and scientism as a philosophical system or worldview. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to ask questions. And we're going to see how they answer them, or how it would be answered or not answered, or just look at, through questions, what the problems are. So the first question is science the supreme giver of knowledge? Oh, by the way, the blanks there are legitimate problems with naturalism and scientism. First question, is science the supreme giver of knowledge? Is it the ultimate authority? Other fields of study also provide valuable and important and actual knowledge that is not worthless or less valuable or authentic than knowledge gained through science. So fields, languages, anthropology, history, archaeology, psychology, sociology, economics, philosophy. Knowledge from science is not more authoritative than knowledge from other disciplines for their respective fields. Each of the above disciplines carries its own weight and its own authority. They speak to their field. So in fact, philosophy, believe it or not, enlightens and provides the foundation for all the other fields. So you could ponder that a little bit. But philosophy is the basis for all knowledge in all fields. It's the foundation, because it has to do with how we talk, how we speak, how we reason, how we think. So no, scientism is not the supreme giver of knowledge and does not have ultimate authority. Thus, scientism fails because it is simply false. Scientism tells us that it is the only source of knowledge. So that's why it fails, because it's false. It's not the only source of knowledge. So that's pretty simplistic. But moving on, did scientism use science to prove itself? Okay, so scientism claims that knowledge is only obtained through science. That is, if it didn't come from science, it isn't knowledge or worth knowing. That's what scientism claims. Okay, so does scientism use science to prove itself? Does it make sense to say that science was used to produce philosophy of scientism? No, science wasn't used to produce the philosophy known as scientism. No hypothesis was used, no testing, no experiment, etc. were performed to yield the result scientism. Science doesn't have the capability to produce scientism. Science doesn't produce a philosophical system or worldview. So thus, since science doesn't produce scientism, scientism doesn't count as knowledge. Because if you look at point A, scientism claims that knowledge is only obtained through science. And since science wasn't used to produce scientism, scientism doesn't count as knowledge. It's just kind of self-refuting. So F, next page, so we discard scientism since it isn't worth knowing. Thus, scientism is self-refuting. Something is self-refuting if it fails to live up to its own definition or standard. Or, if I put this whole thing differently, scientism is a philosophical statement about science. It is not a result of science. That is, it wasn't derived or produced or yielded as an empirical observation or a test result. So, therefore, since science didn't produce scientism, scientism is not rational and it is not knowledge, so it refutes itself. Now, what does this mean? This means that scientism is necessarily false because it is self-contradicting. All self-contradictory statements are necessarily false. What do I mean by that? When something is necessarily false, it has to, it must be, it cannot be anything else but false. It has no choice. Its falsity is necessary. When something is necessarily false, in every possible world, it must be false. Thus, scientism is false in all possible worlds, and in this actual world, because it is self-contradictory. So, if someone teaches scientism or has the view of scientism, they're refuting themselves. And you could just read through that again to feel that out more if you'd like. Limitations to inductive reasoning from empirical observations. So moving on here in this same train of thought about the question, did scientism use science to prove itself? We're looking at plain limitations of inductive reasoning or limitations of empirical observation or the scientific method. So one under K, inductive reasoning. This is the idea that you start with many observations of nature and move toward a few robust explanations of how things work. So how does this work is you reason from the particulars, a bunch of data, to the general. So you take a bunch of data, a bunch of observations, and then you form a conclusion based on that, and that's called induction or inductive reasoning. You reason from the particular to the general. For instance, if I've only seen in my life white-colored cookies, I would perhaps reason that all cookies are white. Something like that. Okay, developing, and the same here, this is another idea of inductive reasoning, developing theories is really looking for the best explanation given existing evidence. So when I develop a theory, I'm looking at all this evidence, and I'm developing a theory, a general theory about reality, gravity, light, particle, waves, whatever. You're developing a theory from a bunch of data or experimentation results or just general observations. And this is known as inductive reasoning. And theories can't, in this reasoning, theories can't be proven, only disproven. So if I find a black-colored cookie, my theory, all white-colored cookies, all cookies are white, that theory is wrong when I find a black cookie. Okay, interestingly, this approach is not a foolproof method of discovering the facts of the universe, but it is helpful. It is helpful. This reasoning is invoked in other disciplines. The principle of induction is used in law, history, psychology, etc. Everybody uses the principle of induction. It's just how we reason. It's how we think. It's just part of being a person and how you interact with others. If I look at everybody out here, I could think all the people in this room speak English. And I've reasoned that because you're in America, and so far you're not, you know, you seem to be paying attention. So I could say that all people that live in America that seem to be paying attention speak English. But I could be wrong, because I could find someone who seems to be paying attention, lives in America, that doesn't speak English. Like Veronica. She's being deported tomorrow. So we're going to pray for her tonight. Okay. All right. So certain fields of science, item 4, such as geology, for example, are not holistically directly accessible to experimentation. So the scientific method is not applicable for this field. Now, some may say, well, there's some things we can do to observe geological phenomena. That's true, but not holistically. So I'm saying that you can't do scientific method on certain parts of the field of geology. So there's a limitation. The whole idea here is that there's limitations to the inductive method on even how we know reality. Other unknowns of science, such as, for example, in quantum physics, the existence of quarks or neutrinos, they're not directly accessible, but these entities are merely postulated as the best explanation of the data. So again, the method is not applicable, because you can't really do induction on that. Now, so reasoning by induction is helpful in many other disciplines, but the scientific method is not nearly a complete method for obtaining knowledge, even in scientific fields. Some scientific fields, or very few, I guess. But reasoning by induction is not necessary. It's not a complete method. Thus, there are limits to the applicability of induction from empirical observations in academia. Now, so we found so far that scientism is self-refuting. The principle of induction is helpful, but it has its limitations. Empiricism, like scientism that we talked about earlier, is self-contradicting. So we're going to talk about how this subset of scientism known as empiricism in itself is self-contradicting. Empiricism claims that all knowledge comes from empirical observations and all ideas are a result of empirical observations. Again, sensory data, the five senses. But this very statement was not an empirical observation. So the statement cannot be considered knowledge and ought to be discarded. So, thus, empiricism is a self-refuting philosophy. So, empiricism is necessarily false and cannot be true in any possible world since it is self-contradicting. Do you see how that works? If empiricism is claiming that all knowledge comes from empirical observations and all ideas are the result of empirical observation, that very statement itself was not a result of empirical observation. So it's self-refuting. Okay, so we're going to skip, actually, this little part. Skip and all the way to page 9, and we're going to start there. page 9. Top of page 9. Okay. Okay. Nueve? Okay, any questions so far before I get into this? Can science validate science as a field of knowledge? Can science validate science as a field of knowledge? No. Since every field has certain assumptions to start the investigation and a logical flow of thought to continue the investigation. So first, you have assumptions. The assumptions of science are not a result of science, they are the result of philosophy. Science assumes the following philosophical assumptions or presuppositions. So we're going to look at the following assumptions or presuppositions that science assumes in order for science to work. Number one, science assumes or presupposes that senses are reliable and can be trusted as givers of accurate information about the world. Okay, so science trusts the senses. Like if I see an observation of an experiment, science presupposes that my senses are trustworthy and they're reporting to me reality. Two, objects exist outside the mind and are real enough to be tested. Science presupposes that I exist, Jesse exists, and we are real. We're not fictitious characters in the mind of some cosmic divine rhino. We are real entities. We are not just a dream of some being. Science presupposes that objects exist outside the mind. The mind is rational and the universe is knowable. This is another thing that science presupposes, that the mind is a rational sort of a thing and the universe itself is knowable. We can know the universe using our mind. That is something that science presupposes in order for someone to do science. Nature is uniform, so that one can use logical induction to refer that past events are good indicators of future events. Examined data is a good indicator of the properties and behavior of unexamined data. And this is important for a scientist to develop theories on how the world works without examining every single phenomena he is testing. So they need to understand that past events are good indicators of future events. Similarly, he doesn't need to live forever to experience all events under consideration. So if I'm a scientist and I'm developing an understanding of something and formulating a theory, I don't need to live from eternity past to eternity future in order to say that this is how the world works. I can just reason by induction out of the data that I've seen. This is how, in general, things happen. I don't need to live forever. The correspondence theory of truth is used. This is something that science presupposes, that certain propositions are true because they correspond with objective reality. The proposition, what was it? Andrea? Andrea is wearing a blue shirt is true because it corresponds with reality. So the statement I made is a proposition. That proposition is true because it corresponds with something in the actual real world. That's the correspondence theory of truth. And science presupposes that. So that's an assumption of science. Unbiased perceptions and appropriate intellectual skepticism are desired when approaching phenomena. Science presupposes that people are going to try as best as they can to be unbiased when they're approaching the results of an experiment or an observation. And science assumes that moral integrity is required in performing scientific observations and reporting results. So if I'm a person that is writing a scholarly journal article out of all this, let's say 10 or 20 years of experimentation, and I submit it to the journal Nature or something like that, Scientific America, or I don't know, something like that, the people that are reading it are presupposing that that guy is reporting results that are true because he's an honest person. He has moral integrity. Science presupposes this in order for science to work in advance. So the second thing about science that we see is that logical flow of thought is used to continue the investigation. Logical flow of thought is used to continue the investigation. Number one, logical flow of thought in science is based in philosophy. Logic falls under philosophy, not science. Logic is required for rational communication and thought processes in any academic field. Science, as well as other fields, owes its thought processes to logic. We cannot reason without logic. Logic is in everything we do. Some people are illogical at times and irrational at times, but that's a different story. Science cannot yield the logic used in science. Science cannot test or verify logic. So science cannot validate logic. Justifying induction as a method of reasoning is a philosophical issue. It's not a science issue. It's a philosophical issue. What justifies your inductive reasoning? How to ground induction? That's an epistemological issue. That's philosophical. Science cannot produce the scientific method. We talked about the scientific method earlier. What produces the scientific method? Logic is necessary. You have to use logic to produce that. It's a thought process that we go through. So we see that certain philosophical presuppositions are assumptions of science, and philosophical logic validates the flow of thought in science. So logic and certain presuppositions are necessary for the field of science to start and continue. They ground science as a rational discipline. But neither are from science, nor can they be verified. They cannot be verified by science. Thus, science cannot validate science as a field of knowledge. And that's the question we first asked. Can science validate science as a field of knowledge? The answer is no. Any questions on that? Kristen. Say it again.
Would obtaining knowledge through science make it valid?
If I obtain knowledge, okay, yeah, I think I get you there. If I obtain knowledge through science, am I validating science? Yes. I'm validating the scientific method or induction. Because the results of my science, my scientific experiment, correspond with the world. So I'm validating the correspondence theory of truth, I'm validating induction, I'm validating logic, I'm validating the philosophical reasoning when approaching science. So yeah, in that sense, it does. Yes, sir. Where's that at?
I'm trying to summarize, I guess.
That's not what I'm saying.
So, what do we need to verify science as a field of knowledge?
No, I'm not even asking that question. That's a different question. I'm just asking the question, can science validate science as a field of knowledge?
Right. And you say that it fails, so I'm wondering what it means.
What would validate science?
Yes.
Well, science validates, philosophy validates science. Because when I get an experiment, and that experiment, I can make a decision based on that experiment. I can state a theory based on that experiment. Then I'm validating science by saying that the scientific method corresponds with reality. So I'm validating the philosophy known as correspondence theory of truth, because that method connects with reality. And that's what science is trying to do. It's trying to teach us about reality, about the universe.
So, what would it mean in order to be valid? I'm sorry.
Philosophy.
But you said about philosophical presupposition.
No, I'm just saying philosophy in general, which is when relates to science, inductive reasoning. So the point of this is to ask the question, can science validate science? Yes. 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 Okay. You can't have science without philosophy. You can't have any discipline without philosophy. That's what I'm saying.
You say that you couldn't have philosophy without language. So then language would.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question.
Each thing I think of something else that requires for that to exist. So in order to have philosophy, I have to have white language. Because if I can't speak, how can I?
Exactly. Philosophize. Yeah, language is necessary. Language is necessary for philosophy. What is the origination of language is the question. That's a great question. I'm not gonna go there right now, but my answer to that is God. But we can get into that. That's a different topic. So God is a originator of language and morality. But that's another topic. Yes, sir. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit, I think last week. Yeah, that's okay. Maybe the first week. The Christian faith is falsifiable.
Well, yeah, but it's integral to the scientific method that a premise can be falsifiable. That's, you can't prove it to be false, it cannot be scientific.
That's right. Yeah, we're going to get into that too, actually. But yeah, falsifiability is important for science, yeah. Yeah, it's part of the scientific method that something is falsifiable. We're not trying to define science necessarily. We're just kind of going through scientism, naturalism. We're not trying to formulate this awesome definition of science, because actually we're going to talk about that in a little bit. What is science? Yeah, that's important. What is science? But I mean, it's for our purposes, we don't need to have a perfect definition, and no one does, frankly. Go ahead. Is there something in Christianity, outside of Christianity, that can be tested, or inside of?
Because I think about things that you see, you can see a lot of things, let's just say an example, I can't give the exact example, but you can see a lot of things that over, say, the life of people that have become Christian, you see a lot of things that have happened over several people have had this experience, or, so then that, if you talk about the steps of the scientific method, you're asking a question, you're researching, hypothesizing, you're experimenting. So I'm asking, I don't know if that's a hard question.
Yeah, so say there's something that's not necessarily a result of an experiment or an observation,
yeah,
or something.
The thing is, I think a lot of scientists, they throw out they say okay, well, this is the natural, they see this, and they throw out anything that has to do with religion. But there's been a lot, but if you see in religion, there's been millions of things that have been duplicated over people's lifetimes.
Okay.
That they've experimented, so how is that thrown out completely?
Yeah, the person who holds to scientism would throw that out,
yeah,
or naturalism. But you're saying, how do those things get verified to be true, like a miracle or a prophecy or a direct awareness of the Holy Spirit or Jesus or something? Yeah, those are observed phenomena. Mm-hmm. So you can say it's an empirical observation. I'm observing Jesus. He's appearing to me right now in the room. The Holy Spirit is healing my body. I feel healing. So it's kind of a physical phenomena. So these are observations. So yeah, science can show that there are these things happening. How they happen, the naturalist or scientist or someone who holds to scientism will say they happen because of these physical processes, whereas the theist would say, no, these things are happening. I'm observing them. You could, test them as they're happening. God is healing my arm, that sort of thing. So the conclusions or implications, what's derived from the observations or after the observations, that's a different thing. But science can show that there are cells moving around or vibrating or something and healing. Well, the Christian would say the healing is taking place.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, the same experimental testing equipment could be used on that.
Yeah.
Or if someone's leg grows, you know, we hear about stories about people's leg growing, and just stick a measuring tape and watch it grow.
Yeah.
You know, if God is causing the leg to grow, then there's measuring tape, and we can measure lots of things, you know, so measuring tape. Yeah, and so that goes back to the worldview issue. Yeah, how are these things happening? Something science could teach us. What is happening physically or physiologically? And then how do we explain it? What best explains the cause of that? That's a different question that science doesn't really answer. What causes that activity to occur initially? Well, science actually could say, if it's depending on someone's determinism, they would say, well, the previous cause caused it, not the prayer you just prayed. It was just because it was time for those chemicals to move that way. Question?
Well, I was just going to say that although you can't necessarily use science to explain the origin, but you can use science to say, okay, I think it might have been this was the reason that they were healed. Let me use science to test that. Right. That's what the scientific is about. Scientific method is about is that you can have an explanation and then keep testing. Like, oh, okay, if this is the real explanation, then I should be able to do these steps and produce this result. Does that help the explanation?
Yeah.
Because that's where I guess the core problem is, like, that science will tend to shy away from an explanation of that supernatural and tend to zoom in more on one that's much more physical because I can test that and I can make predictions based on that. Does that...
Yeah, so just talking about science and the scientific method, yeah. Okay, so the third question we ask scientism and naturalism, can science validate, sorry, we already did that, didn't we? Yeah. Okay, page 11. Do scientists or philosophers of science agree on a standard definition of science? And we just talked about this actually a second ago. So no, there is no standard definition that a majority agree on. Some definitions fall short of describing certain experiments. Other definitions explain other non-scientific fields as scientific. Hold on a second. I'm not sure what I'm trying to say there. Okay. That was a strange thought. Not capturing what I'm trying to say there. Okay. D. This is a good definition of science, but again, it's just one definition amongst many. There's hundreds of these definitions. You can go to every textbook probably out there, and there's going to be a slight variation. You're going to get a lot of different definitions. So this is a definition. A natural science is a theoretically explained discipline that attempts to objectively addresses natural phenomena within the general constraints that, one, its theories must be rationally connectable to generally specifiable empirical phenomena, and that, two, it normally does not leave the natural realm for the concepts employed in its explanations. So it stays within the natural realm when it's trying to explain something. So again, science wouldn't say there's a miracle. That's outside the natural realm. Okay, but again, that's not saying anything bad or good. It's just trying to describe reality. In that sense. So again, it attempts to. That's what I'm saying here in point two. It's attempt to objectively address natural phenomena. It may get it wrong, and the theories may be wrong. The theories may later be changed and disproven. That's just what happens. Even if a standard definition were to emerge, a standard definition of science, the adequacy of that definition of science would not itself be a scientific issue, but a philosophical one, and thus such a definition would itself illustrate the limits of science. So in other words, philosophy is grounding all this thinking that science uses to do stuff and to figure out stuff. And a good definition of science is not a scientific issue, it's a philosophical issue. Science can't tell me that this definition of science is a good definition. Philosophy can. Thus, the definition of science is not agreed on, which speaks to the limitation of science to explain everything. So there's limitations that we see here. And so that's just part of this whole idea that naturalism and scientism are limited and aren't very good at describing what they say they're describing. How is naturalism perceived in the community of philosophers? Okay, so now we're going to look at naturalism as a philosophy, just digging into this in several different ways. And the scientific and humanities community, or communities, is mostly naturalistic in orientation. So if you go to a college campus, you go to a humanities building or a science building, a lot of people in there that are scientists or working in the humanities would most likely subscribe to some form of naturalism, a lot of these professors. However, most philosophers of science are not naturalists. So if you go into the philosophy building, none of those guys are going to be naturalists. And they're the ones that, and naturalism is, again, a philosophy. Most philosophers agree that reductionism has not succeeded in ethics and the philosophy of mind. And we're going to talk about reductionism later. But reductionism is a part of naturalism. Eliminativism is still largely a minority position amongst naturalists, especially in the philosophy of mind, mostly because it is widely thought either to contradict what is obvious or to be self-refuting. So eliminativism is something that says that all of these things are just matter. All of these thoughts are just matter in motion in my brain, and everything in the universe is just matter. So it's eliminating. It reduces phenomena to such a point that it eliminates it as we understand it. And so denying beliefs and thoughts is contradictory to human experience. So when someone says that your thoughts are not thoughts, they're just brain chemistry and electrochemical interactions happening in your brain, that's, you're going to think, oh my God, that's totally not true. I'm totally having a thought right now. You're telling me I'm not, but I'm pretty darn sure I'm thinking. And so denying beliefs and thoughts is what the reductionist and the naturalist is going to do. They're going to deny your beliefs and thoughts exist. Believing or thinking about a view that denies believing and thinking is self-refuting. If we don't have beliefs, then the eliminativist can't believe in eliminativism. So if I'm an eliminativist or a naturalist, I can't believe in that view. I can't believe in eliminativism because I'm not having a thought about it. And definitely not a belief. So it's self-refuting. Critics of naturalism point out the lack of success of naturalism to account for the human mind and ethics. So if you're a philosopher, you typically, pretty much all philosophers, reject naturalism because it doesn't explain everything. It says it does, but it doesn't. And so naturalism, most naturalists actually agree and concede to the lack of success, but hold their position anyway. So if you're Richard Dawkins or someone that is a scientist, not a philosopher, who is a naturalist, you're going to recognize that there are limitations to the view, but you're going to hold to it anyway. And you may even recognize that it's self-refuting and hold to it anyway. But again, in the past 50, 60, 70 years of philosophy, pretty much that naturalism has been done away with as a philosophical system. Pretty much it's completely rejected. by philosophers as something that is should not be held to. Although naturalism still dominates the science and humanities, it is backpedaling from the challenges of theism and dualism. So Christians, apologists are out there making waves in academia and challenging the idea of naturalism, challenging the scientists who hold it and challenging the humanists who hold it, or those in the humanities who hold it. And so many agree that it will never be able to account for the human mind, ethics, and other real, non-material entities. We're going to talk about what sorts of things are real, non-material entities shortly. Yes?
What's dualism?
Dualism is the view that I have a soul and a body. I'm a dual-natured entity.
How are you defining the human mind in this context, the one that naturalism can't account for? Briefly, we don't have to get into
it. Yeah, so we're going to talk about two ways that naturalism accounts for the human mind. One is the reductionist view that says the human mind is just matter in motion, electrochemical activity. There is no mind. We just call it a mind because brains are firing stuff and social customs have called it mind. The other view is called epiphenomenalism. Epiphenomenalism is the view that holds to emergent properties. So a mind emerges out of the brain, the physical brain. There's some sort of mind above it. It's an emergent entity, and it kind of goes along wherever the brain goes. So we're going to talk about that later. Okay, we'll do one more. Let's see here. Yeah. Can the main point of naturalism, that no supernatural entities exist whatsoever anywhere, be proven? Can the main point of naturalism be proven? So this is what is called an absolute or universal negative proposition as it denies supernatural beings. Okay, so what that means is that when you have an absolute or universal negative, that means you're saying that at all times, everywhere, what I'm saying here in B, this is how it's usually framed in a positive manner, in all times, everywhere, all entities whatsoever, anywhere, at any time, are purely material in nature. So from when time began till now and in the future, all times, everywhere in the entire universe, there's never been a supernatural or a non-material entity. That's what naturalism is saying. And so that is called, in philosophy, an absolute or universal negative proposition. But this has the same implication as the negative version. Oh, I must have deleted the negative version, sorry. I wrote out the negative version of how it could be phrased, and then I deleted it. So you can just ignore C. so they both, the negative and positive way to phrase that, suffer the same result. Universal negatives are impossible to prove. One would have to be everywhere at all times and check all entities in a manner that proves there were absolutely no supernatural beings present. This is impossible. One cannot be everywhere at all times and checking in some sort of manner that proves that there was no supernatural being there. You would have to be God to do that. So what is the naturalist claiming when he espouses his view, when he says that there are no supernatural entities anywhere, ever, at any time? He's kind of saying he's God. He knows that. He knows that to be true. And that's a God-like sort of knowledge, omniscience. Thus, because it is impossible to prove a universal negative, and the main point of naturalism is that no supernatural entities exist anywhere at any time, naturalism is impossible to prove. Naturalism is impossible to prove. Any questions on that? Okay. We're going to move on. Actually, we could... Do you want to do one more? Or do you want to stop there?
Do one more.
Okay, one more. We're about almost at 8:45, so this should be perfect, because that's when we're scheduled to stop. All right. Can naturalism account for the existence of these non-material entities? So, if we look at what a non-material entity is, we have to say, does naturalism as a philosophy or worldview, do they account for them? How do they include these things? If any of the following entities are real, naturalism is defeated. So, if any of these things exist, then naturalism as a worldview should be rejected. Words, language, colors, numbers, thoughts, theories, propositions, meaning and purpose to life, or purpose to an action, or purpose to a written phrase, like what I just wrote, logical expressions and the laws of logic, emotions, desires. Again, if any of these things are real, even though they're not material, the naturalism that says everything is material has to be rejected. Outer body experiences. Mind as separate entities from brains. If the mind is something different than the brain, the naturalism must be defeated. Souls. If a soul exists, or God, then obviously something that's non-material is there. Human relationships. Is the concept of relationship real? If that concept that Veronica is my friend, if that is real, that relationship, then that's also a non-material abstract entity. It's called a relationship. The value or worth of an object. If an object has value or worth, then that's an abstract idea or entity, worth, value. Moral action. Is that moral action a good or bad thing? That idea of morality, moral law, these are non-material, real parts of our universe. Dimensional relations, here to over there, from there to there, that is a dimensional relation. If that relationship is real, that it, something is over there and it's also not over there, they're separate, then again, that relationship is a real thing, but it's non-material, it's a relationship. Over and under, large and small. These are relationships, things to each other things, things to other things. And these relationships point to a non-material entity, an abstract reality known as relationship. Intentionality, ofness and aboutness. So every thought I think is of or about something. So you could call that intentionality. I'm intending to think of the grass. I have a thought about flying an airplane. I'm thinking of things or about things, and the thought in my mind is of something or about something. And if that ofness and aboutness, that is non-material. The thought has a property that's non-material. The thought itself is non-material. Universals, this is a philosophical concept that has to do with the properties of objects, ideas, relations of objects and ideas. These are universals that instantiate themselves in physical beings. So these are abstract phenomena that are in things, and they're in other things. Like that blueness of that sweatshirt is blue. So blue is instantiated. It's a universal. It's instantiated there, and it's instantiated there. And both sweatshirts are blue, so blue is a universal. And again, that's not material. It's a universal. It's an abstract entity. Justice and injustice. These are non-material things, but they're real. Some things are really just and some are really unjust. Truth and falsity. Something is really true and something is really false. The fact that I'm talking right now is true. It is not false. That whole concept of truth and falsity is non-material. Morality and immorality. Those things are real, but they're not material. Undeniable features of human persons. Consciousness. Libertarian free will. Rationality, a unified self, an I, I'm an I, the whole concept of me, I have identity through change. My body changes, but I'm the same thing. I'm unified. Intrinsic value. The humans have intrinsic value. We care about other humans, even though sometimes they annoy us. We're not going to kill them because there's something valuable to a human. And it makes no sense to perform an experiment on, like, weigh or measure something like these real entities. You're not going to perform an experiment on justice. Or, for instance, how much does goodness weigh? How heavy is logic? How heavy is logic? There's no scientific experiment that can tell us that. It doesn't make sense. What position, speed, and rotation does justice have as it travels through space? I can't do a Newtonian equation on that. No scientific observation of these entities no scientific observations of these entities cannot be performed. And so no, naturalism does not account for these non-material entities. Okay, so overall, it is not that naturalism just doesn't have a better explanation of all these entities or an equally sound version. They don't have an explanation at all. They just bypass it. Now, I'll tell you something in a few minutes that will soften that a little bit. But that is, by categorical definition of naturalism, they are ruled out. They're ruled out of existence. These things don't exist. Your emotions, justice, logic, all that. So either we deny that these features exist, so naturalism stands untarnished, or we can't deny that we have these features, so naturalism, again, must be rejected. Some forms of naturalism will attempt to adopt some of these entities, such as minds and morality, and features in the worldview by reducing them to effects of material causes. So some naturalists will say, okay, you've got it. I can't reject all of these things. They're obviously real. So how does the naturalist account for them? They have to modify naturalism to try to include them. And so this strategy ultimately fails. And although we don't have time to reveal each reductionist strategy, some forms of reductionism will be refuted later in this class. Because a lot of times, what will happen is naturalists, the scientists especially, will point to evolution to account for all of these things we just saw, all of that stuff. They're going to say that natural processes created these things. So it's a modified form of naturalism. And we're going to look at that later in the class. These reductionist attempts have failed. And so how do people, what do philosophers think of these reductionist strategies? Do they work? These reductionist attempts have failed, and physicalism as a worldview cannot adequately handle the existence of these entities. And much of the motivation to hold to naturalism is to be consistent in rejecting the mind or soul and God. But if it is true that the mind or God exists, then much of the reasons for holding to naturalism is removed. So if someone could show that the mind or God exists, then you really don't have much reason to hold on to naturalism. Because most of the time, the naturalist scientist will hold that view because he thinks that there's no God and no soul, and naturalism best explains the world. Okay, any questions on that? If not, we'll go ahead and close. Okay, let's close in a little word of prayer. Dear Lord Jesus, thank you for tonight, and we pray that you would guide our minds, guide our hearts, as we attempt to learn about your world and learn how to think about it, and learn what things to not think, what things that are false, and that you guide us to truth, guide us to understand reality, and understand you better. We believe, God, that you created all things, and including ourselves. And we pray that you would help us to know you and ourselves better and draw closer to you because of it. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, thank you for coming. If you have any questions, I'll be up here for a little while. And I'll be talking with John a little bit after the class. John is a professional filmmaker. All right. Thanks a lot.